Welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we will find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is technology writer and podcaster Dan Morin. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Pleasure to be here, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So tell us what you have come on the show to talk about and then give us some context around it, its release, its reception, why it is maligned and why you think that that is wrong.
Well, okay, so this one I'm sure is gonna raise some hackles here and there. I've picked the movie from, I believe, 2006, which is M. Night Shyamalan's, and already people are booing if I know any indication, Lady in the Water. And I think this is, you know, this is the movie that I think a lot of people were convinced that Shyamalan sort of went off the rails, because he had done the very successful The Sixth Sense, obviously. He'd made at this point also, I believe, Unbreakable, which I think is probably, in my mind, my favorite work of his. But this one was kind of weirdly marketed, and it was presented as almost sort of a horror movie, like a lot of his other movies. He'd also done, I think at this point, Signs and The Village, which I think sort of, you know, there's a sort of a declining scale here of movies that
diminishing people like returns.
Really, exactly. Yeah. But I honestly think I have a soft spot for The Village as well, though I recognize its flaws. And I recognize that this movie too has flaws, but I think that the level of animosity that it received upon its release was just so out of proportion with the movie that's actually here. And I think so much of it has to do with the perception of him as an auteur, as someone who is a writer and a director, and in this case, also an actor in this movie. And so a lot of people, I think the critical reception was not great. The box office was pretty terrible. Everybody, I think, also expected it to have sort of a twist in it. And this is, I think, the first of his movies that doesn't really contain like a pull the rug from out from under you twist. And I think that, you know, largely it was mismarketed, and it was marketed heavily on reliance of his name, and people had started to feel like maybe they'd figured out his shtick. And so I think, you know, sort of a confluence of all those factors came together to make it sort of heavily derided. And I think that some of its flaws, which we'll discuss, contribute to that, and especially to a perception of self-indulgence on his part, on Shyamalan's part, that really caused sort of a backlash. But I think it's possible to set some of those aside and see what is actually a lovely fantasy fairy tale movie that I think is really fascinating, especially to anybody who really loves the construction of stories.
Talking about the critical reaction for a moment, before we get into the content, I think part of the issue as well was that there are certain elements within the movie and a certain attitude within the movie that is very clearly Shyamalan giving the middle finger to his critics and basically saying, you're all idiots who don't know what you're talking about. I'm an auteur. You're just critics. What do you know? And, in 20 years' time, people will remember me and nobody will remember you. All of which is probably true.
Yep.
You know, and to a certain extent, justified. God knows I've, you know, felt that sort of sting myself from critics in the past. However, it is also a kind of unwritten golden rule that you shouldn't do that.
Yes.
That you shouldn't engage with your critics like that, because it comes across as petty. And it really does come across as petty here.
Yep.
and I think that's part of the critical reaction to the movie as well, is that literally the critics themselves were like, well, hang on a second. Most of this movie is based around him telling us that he's a genius and that we're idiots. Well, of course they're going to give it bad reviews. What do you expect?
Yeah, I think you're totally right. There are, to sort of, you know, say the two major flaws, I think, in this movie are, one, a side plot dealing with a character, as you said, that literally embodies his critics and who is essentially savagely murdered, right? Like that, there is no...
Well, and who gets everything wrong.
Right, exactly.
Every kind of prediction or supposition that character makes in the movie is completely wrong.
Right. And there's no sub, it's not even subtext. It's just out there. It's literally stated, right? And so that's one major flaw. And I think that is just, it's, you know, I think you're right. He got frustrated. He decided to take it out on his critics. And that was, you're right, don't sink to that level. I think that is a problem. And that is why so much of this is, there are problematic elements in that. Between that and the fact that, because on the other end of the scale, the sort of martyr, virtuous character is literally played by him.
Yeah.
I think that was a mistake as well. I do not think he should have cast himself. I think, honestly, you know, if you wanted to make it more subtextual instead, he could have, you know, just cast a different actor, at which point it would not have at least been, you know, hitting you in the face. And it's not even that he's that bad an actor. He's fine. He's serviceable. But the fact that he is casted in this,
you know, fact that it's him, yeah,
is a problem. Yeah. And that is unfortunate, because I think it really, it sort of pulls the rug out from what otherwise could have been a very interesting story to tell. So I think if you can, if those two elements had been changed, I think maybe this movie would be a little easier to defend just sort of wholeheartedly. That said, I think there's still a lot of beauty and just great choices in direction and writing in this movie that I adore. So I want to set those aside for a moment, and we should talk about why this is still a good movie.
Okay, well, that's interesting that you say that. I agree with half of that statement. I mean, yes, you're absolutely right that if he had cast somebody else, even if he'd cast somebody who looked a bit like him,
sure, yeah,
you know, you'd still, there's still room there to say, ah, well, it's allegory, you see. But when he literally casts himself in the role of, yes, not just any character, but the central martyr-like, my work, literally, my work is going to change the world for the better.
I mean... Yeah, that was, again, like I said, self-indulgent, and I think, you know, no one, in that case, it's clear to me that obviously no one is more to blame for the flaws and failures of this movie than M. Night Shyamalan himself.
Oh, sure, sure.
Because he made that decision.
Do you wish to know your future? A boy. In the Midwest of this land, will grow up in a home where your book will be on the shelf and spoken of often. He will grow up with these ideas in his head. He will grow into a great orator. He will speak, and his words will be heard throughout this land and throughout the world. This boy will become leader of this country and begin a movement of great change. He will speak of you and your words. Your book will be the seeds of many of his great thoughts. It will be the seeds of change.
I remember when this movie came out. I hadn't seen this movie before I watched it for the show. And I remember when it came out, a friend of mine who works in Hollywood and has sort of followed Shyamalan's career with interest. Not, you know, kind of detached interest, but nevertheless, just as a kind of watching the, you know, the ups and downs of his career, he mentioned it to me and sort of, when he told me that Shyamalan himself is in the movie, and oh, by the way, yeah, and he plays in the movie a writer whose work is going to change the world. And I was just like, you're having me on. Surely, surely you cannot, nobody can be that, can have that huge lack of self-awareness, surely, but no.
Yeah, so there are definitely issues with this movie, and
okay, so that aside, as you say, let's get to the actual content, you know, meta stuff aside. You said you think there are some great choices with the direction and the writing. I agree with the direction part of that. I was sorely disappointed in the writing and the actual story of this. And that was before I even knew, because I deliberately didn't sort of look anything up about it until after I'd watched it. That was before I knew that he apparently based the story on a bedtime story that he made up for his children.
Right.
Which is very cute.
Yeah,
great.
Sure.
You know, good, nice idea. But, you know, not so sure it worked. So what did you like about the story?
Well, I mean, so I saw this movie... I would say I saw it maybe a year or two after it came out. I watched it on Netflix or something, you know, And I was surprised because it was one of those things where I had seen the trailers and I'd been like, well, okay, you know, I had all the same preconceptions, but I sort of went into it not really knowing anything about it. And I think what I really enjoy about it is I'm a fan of the sort of meta-textual story analysis. You know, I think of series like Stephen King's Dark Tower, which, you know, really delves into similar themes here as like someone, you know, stories and how they're put together and, you know, sort of gets down to the elemental level of it. And so I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that it's sort of a crypto fantasy, right? Because it does seem like it's based in our world. I would agree that some, you know, I don't necessarily think there's any huge winners here in terms of dialogue. I think a lot of the dialogue is very on the nose and isn't really particularly effective. But I think that I enjoy sort of the overall telling of it in terms of these thematic archetypes that are put into it. And I also enjoy, you know, if you look at the Joseph Campbell's work, The Hero of a Thousand Faces, things like that, there is very much sort of a hero's journey going on here with the main character, Cleveland Heap, played by Paul Giamatti, who starts off as this kind of shy, retiring he's a superintendent of this apartment complex. And he, you know, we learn later on has had this terrible tragedy in his life and he's just sort of hidden himself away. And then he finds himself called on to, you know, do something supernatural and you know, heroic.
There are humans with powers that can help her. And these people have been unconsciously drawn to live near the vessel. Now, these humans don't know who they are. And they always appear in the story earlier.
Are there humans with powers that can help you but don't know who they are? That's a yes!
They've got weird names. A symbolist, a guardian, and a guild. Ask her if that's right.
You want something. One of them. Vic. Mr. Heath. Mr. Heap is one of them. Which one? Guild, guardian? She thinks Mr. Heap is the guardian.
I was told that there's a symbolist, an interpreter who can read.
And so I enjoy that sort of archetypal story of the hero's journey, the call to adventure and all of that. And I think that I really like the assembly of characters throughout this movie. We do get these like little snatches of people as we go through, and what seems like it might just be almost like a slice of life drama for like the first half an hour or so actually ends up turning into this very ethereal other world story. And I like that it does sort of wholeheartedly embrace a message that I really appreciate, which is the idea of having something beyond just this sort of plain existence that we all live in, which several of the characters, you know, appeal to, this wanting to believe in something greater. And I think all of that, you know, as a theme, I really enjoy those types of movies where the sort of the veil is peeled away and it turns out that there is more to reality than what we just see around us. And so playing with that and introducing all these interesting, I like a lot of the characters. I enjoy, you know, that there are mistakes made along the way as they try to figure out who these supposed, you know, archetypal characters are in amongst the group. I love that it's all contained in this apartment complex. It's really claustrophobic in a way, which is not something you really get with fantasy stories. You often have these great sprawling set pieces. And here we're all of the action is contained within this apartment complex in Philadelphia. And so I think that is an interesting contrast to this greater world out there. And the fact that it is such a mundane locale, that it's an apartment building, right? It's not a castle. It's not a amazing vista. There's nothing pretty about this apartment building. It's cinder block and concrete and metal railings and kind of dingy and run down. And the people who we meet here are not exactly, you know, people that you would think of traditionally as hero roles. I love some of the casting is fantastic. A lot of these characters, there's a true diversity of cast here, I feel like, which is not something you also get in a lot of fantasy movies.
True.
And so having all those elements come to play, and they kind of work for me.
I also love sort of stories about stories and that kind of meta. You know, I'm a big fan of the Sandman comic, for example.
Absolutely.
You know, I love that sort of thing. But I don't know, this one just didn't. I mean, you say that, you know, you said you liked the message, but it didn't, other than, yes, okay, you know, this, there is more to this world, Horatio, and all that. I didn't really get any kind of idea of a message from this. That was one of my big, towards the end of the movie, you know, in my notes, I was like, what is the message here? Like, because I have no problem with fairy story type stories, you know, with things where there are arbitrary rules about, you know, fairy creatures and sort of the idea of they've lived here for centuries and they have a natural enemy and there are rules about how they can engage, that sort of thing. That's an established part of fairy tale lore. That's a trope. Fine, you know, no problem with that sort of thing. But beyond that, there just didn't seem, it didn't seem to be sort of going anywhere. I don't know. I just had a really hard time pinning down, other than, you know, make a movie about the story that he had made up for his kids. I had a really hard time pinning down exactly what he was trying to do with this movie. I mean, you mentioned the hero's journey, or Hero with a Thousand Faces and all that. And I kind of felt like this movie only addressed like the first half of that cycle. And maybe that's why, for me, it was quite disappointing, because part of, a very important part of the hero's journey is leaving the comfortable original world behind and journeying into the unknown to then return having learned, you know, the sort of the mystical secrets, or, you know, gained the mystical treasure or whatever. Paul Giamatti's character never actually leaves, either metaphorically or physically. I mean, yes, it all takes part in an apartment complex, and that is very good. Although, how on earth did this movie cost $70 million, given that it never leaves the apartment complex?
Well, hey, a giant eagle isn't cheap, guys. No, I think you're totally right. In some ways, I think this would have been better served for by having... It lacks a bit of denouement, right? Like, we have the climactic scene where the eagle arrives to take story, you know, away, and we're left kind of with Paul Giamatti's character standing there by the pool. And in some ways, I feel like it would have been well served by a denouement in which we get to see him decide to, you know, we discover that he has left his previous life because his family was murdered. He was a doctor, you know, like, these are kind of interesting things that are only dropped sort of briefly, but it would have been nice to see him decide, for example, that he should leave the apartment complex and sort of re-enter his own life, become sort of, you know, reactualize there. I agree that that would have provided a little more of a theme.
Right, and that is hinted at.
Yes.
You know, there's sort of conversations between him and what's she called? The Narf,
is it?
Character, where that's sort of implied that, you know, that he probably will do that afterwards. And again, you know, don't mind movies that sort of imply things that will happen after the end that you don't necessarily see. But even that, I think, you know, still wouldn't be, I don't know, for me, it just wouldn't have been fully satisfying. There was a lot of people talking about how important things were, and very little actual evidence of things were important, you know?
Yeah, even the book that the writer, that Shyamalan himself is writing, is nothing is given away about what it contains. In fact, I would say, again, one of the weaker parts of this movie is he just kind of, when he's asked what his book is about.
Man, I don't understand something. I'm sorry, my ladder accidentally bumped into your desk. I ended up seeing the title of what it is you're writing. It said the cookbook.
I know, it's a bad title, right? It's actually, you know, just my thoughts on all the cultural problems and thoughts on leaders and stuff.
Yeah. I feel like that is, in, you know, I wanted to talk with you too about this movie because we're both writers, and because I think there are certain things that we identify with, but at the same time, and that's one of the probably worst things that we identify with. Like, I'm sure we all went through that phase of writing where it's like, yeah, I'm going to write this thing. It's going to change the world. And, you know, it's about all the problems. And then you realize that's not actually how you get anything done.
Certainly. Also, I've been through that phase where somebody asks you what your book's about, and you just kind of go, well, it's a thing about a thing. And, you know, it's
there's a guy and a thing.
Yeah, we've all done that. Yeah,
sure. but you kind of want it, if you're going to attack sort of the metatextual nature of this, you kind of want it to be like, you want there to be a more concrete idea. You want to have a sort of a sharper knife if you're going in to talk about what this world-changing manuscript actually entails, if it's going to be the focus point of your movie. And I agree, it comes out of more of a wishful thinking place for Shyamalan, I think, than an actual, like, really concrete idea of what this message is. And you're totally right that there's a lot of this is muddled. At times, the rules of the world are kind of muddled. And there is definitely a decided lack of what is sort of the central point you're trying to make here. And I think, honestly, again, I think it would have been a sharper movie if he had ditched his own personal axes to grind and focused a little bit more on the main thrust of the story. I think that this, you know, could have been enhanced greatly, but I think he gets so bogged down in trying to attack what he sees as his detractors that he loses the thread a little bit. You know, this is the kind of thing that suffers from, you know, not having a good editor to sort of look at your piece and say, maybe tone this part down a little bit and get back to what you're really trying to say here.
Right. And we've seen that. I mean, you know, look at George Lucas's Exhibit A.
Oh, yeah.
For that, you know, like just needing somebody standing there to go, hang on a second, that's no good. And, you know, George Lucas is by no means alone in that. There are many, many, I've ranted about this at length in the past, many, many filmmakers, authors, musicians who become so...
They buy into their hype, right? Like...
Well, it's not just that they buy into it. It's that everybody else becomes terrified of telling them that something they do might not be a work of genius. And I think that is one of the most dangerous things that can happen to a creator.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I wonder if that sort of did happen to Shyamalan a bit. I should say, I still think Sixth Sense is a wonderful piece of filmmaking. I remember I went into that movie knowing nothing at all about it. I had no idea what to expect. And I came out absolutely blown away, convinced that Shyamalan, if he could keep this up, was going to be, you know, one of the most important filmmakers of the sort of the next 10 or 20 years. I, however, unlike you, was incredibly disappointed by Unbreakable.
Yeah.
I really, really dislike that movie.
I really like it, but maybe save that for another time.
Yeah. And I, you know, I'm wondering, and I'm literally just wondering this now, maybe the reason I had such a sort of negative reaction to this movie is because I wanted it to be good. Like I say, you're absolutely right. All the ingredients are there for a good story. And if he had just taken out the self-indulgent aspects and, you know, got involved, got somebody to come in and go, okay, let's pull this apart, figure out what you're trying to do and, you know, make a good screenplay out of it, then maybe I would have enjoyed it more. And it can't, maybe that's my disappointment. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That it feels like it's almost there. It could have been so good and yet it falls short. This is a movie that really could have done with going through that Pixar story group.
Yeah, right.
You know?
But I mean, you know, to set that aside for a second, I think some of the other ingredients here that make this work really well for me, you know, I think we could probably both agree that from a technical standpoint, Shyamalan is I think he's a great director from standpoint.
Yeah.
He has an eye. He is incredibly, he pays incredible attention to detail. In any of his movies, no matter how bad, if you just look at the direction, you can see that there is a guy here who is elevating beyond just like what most of your directors are trying to do. And I think that is, you know, the sort of thing I take away from it. Even in, you know, I have the soft spot for The Village. I don't think it's a great movie, but I think it's again, as a directorial showpiece, it's a beautiful looking movie. And he spends so much time focusing on framing and on color and on the uses of particular angles and camera movement. I love that this movie, it's fairly static as far as the camera goes, but there are dynamic shots here and there that are kind of reserved for moments that are really important. There's a lot of use of doorways, of the camera moving through doorways. Even the very first shot, which is like from inside the cabinet and then moving out, and then there's shots later on from inside Cleveland's house moving out. And I think that there's really just a fantastic looking movie, if nothing else. And I think that's pretty much universally true of his movies. Up to a point, anyways. I haven't seen I have not seen most of his recent movies, which I think are more, he sort of moved into, you know, directing things that he doesn't necessarily write, which may be a good long-term choice for him.
That's probably a good move, yeah.
But maybe, hey, maybe when he grows up a little bit in another 10 years or something, he'll try his hand, having learned a lot along the way.
Maybe so, yeah. I mean, yes, I was going to move into that myself. I agree that story aside, technically this is a wonderful movie. It's very, I mean, obviously it's sort of skillfully shot and stuff, but the performances are pretty good as well.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, okay, the performance of the guy as the critic is, you know, stilted, and
poor Bob Balaban, who is a great character actor, but is kind of woefully underused here as just,
well, and you have to wonder how much of that was direction as well. Yeah. How much of it is him doing what Shyamalan told him to do,
specifically in his death scene, especially where, yeah, he essentially narrates right out loud like what's going to happen, and then of course gets the, you know, the rug pulled out on from. And there's a, you know, there's even a point in the idea of talking about conventions and cliches and commenting on that.
Oh,
but
sure,
again, this, yeah, was not the way to do it.
No, but not in this way. Yeah, and when he does actually, you know, spoilers, his death scene, when he does die, it really reminded me of Anthony Perkins' death scene in The Black Hole.
Oh yeah,
if you remember that.
Yeah,
there was just something about it that really brought that to mind. I don't know, but maybe that's my own particular peccadilloes. But it looks fantastic. The cinematography as well is amazing in,
yeah,
this.
Yeah.
Christopher Doyle, who's Wong Kar-wai's, was Wong Kar-wai's cinematographer, and also did The Quiet American. Don't know,
yep,
if you've seen that.
Oh,
that's,
yeah,
a beautiful movie. And Jim Jarmusch's Limits of Control. So real top flight talent, this guy. And as a result, it looks amazing. It's beautifully lit. It's beautifully shot. As I say, the performances are, you know, generally good. I wouldn't say anybody is amazing in it, but certainly nobody is bad in it. Even Shyamalan.
Yeah, he's fine.
Yeah, he's fine. Yeah. It's just the script. Well, and the actress who plays Shyamalan's sister is, I'd never seen her before. She's British, apparently.
Yeah, she actually has a recurring role on Homeland as, I think she plays Mandy Patinkin's wife for a bunch,
wow,
of it. She's great. I agree. I really like,
yeah,
her.
So, you know, again, all the ingredients and the special effects are not, I mean, there aren't many special effects, but what there is fine, especially again for the time, 2006.
I like that it's subtle a lot of the times too. I really love the envisioning of the skrunts, the wolves sort of that have the grass on their backs, that they lie flat and they're invisible, and then you can only see their eyes in a mirror behind you. Like, I love that conception. I think that creature is so good as sort of the nameless menace. I enjoy that a lot. And there, you're right, there aren't a lot of special effects. I think they're used sparingly and well, because, you know, what I think Shyamalan does know most of the time is that the things that are not seen are more frightening than,
yes,
the things that are seen. And so having them appear in the shadows and the mist, at least for the first, you know, three quarters of the movie or so, it makes it that much more frightening that you never get like a really good look at it. Plus the effects don't hold up as well when you do. So,
well, yeah, it's just say 2006, you know, but also doing things with sound,
yes,
rather than visuals. It is much easier to fool humans with sound than with sight. I don't know why that is, but for some reason it is much easier for us to hear sounds and be convinced that they are, to let our sort of imagination take over and be convinced that they are, you know, something new, real, mm-hmm, convincing, than to see something. It's the uncanny valley effect, isn't it? You know,
yeah,
see,
right,
something that is not
clearly
quite
not
right,
yeah,
and we just instantly know it's fake, that's not real. So yes, very, very smart. You know, Hitchcock famously,
yep,
did the same sort of thing. And the special effects when they do appear are fine. The scrunt is much better than the tartutic.
Although I think some of those are at least I think motion capture people, because Doug Jones, who is one of those well-known, he played, if you ever saw the Hellboy movies, he was Abe Sapien.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So
yeah.
He's in there as one of those. So they use some combination of motion capture. It must be those guys. It couldn't just be guys in suits, I guess. But yeah, they're not as good. I think partially they suffer from looking a little too
Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, a little too samey too. To the, like, there's a tree, like sort of gnarled tree appearance to them that I think gets a little too close to the scrunts for me. I would have liked them to look a little more alien in some ways. But the sound,
yeah,
I think is a good point that you make, because I wanted to specifically call out James Newton Howard's score, which I think is awesome.
Which is very good, yes.
I picked up the score after watching this movie the first time, which, again, was like 8 or 9 years ago now. And I've listened to that score for 8 or 9 years, so I know it really well now. And I just think it's a fantastic piece of music. Particularly the sort of climactic like events. There's a couple tracks at the end of it that sort of lead up to the final confrontation. And I think that music is just, it's great. He does a great job with the music here. It's really evocative. It kind of does all these different things. You've got the sort of the blue world underneath the pool. You've got the, you know, the sort of more pedestrian stuff happening around the apartment building. And then you've got these great sort of epic moments like the final confrontation. I think that, you know, again, like so many, you could harken back to the prequels here and say, if you cut out a lot of the dialogue and you watch the movie with just the music, the sound, you know, it would actually probably be better in some ways.
That's probably a fair point. Yeah. Yeah. Cause I mean, none of the dialogue is sort of memorable at all.
No.
Like, which really, you know, is a bit of a problem when you're writing a story about stories.
Yep.
There's not a single line of it that really kind of, you know, stands out as quotable or significant or memorable. And at one point, Bryce Dallas Howard's character actually says,
"There's a storm coming."
It's like the rosy fingers of dawn. You just know, just don't do it.
Well, which is funny because, you know, in that moment where there's a scene where Paul Giamatti is talking to the film critic character who says, people were just walking around saying their feelings out loud. Who does that? You know, and it's like, well, you're kind of doing it right now. So,
yeah, I mean, that's if that was meant to be some kind of meta-textual comment on the movie,
backfired a bit.
Yeah.
So I would agree with you that the I think the performances overall are pretty great. I really love Jeffrey Wright, who appears here briefly as the father, the crossword puzzle solver.
And
I like him in so many of his other roles that I kind of get, you get sort of that halo effect from like, oh man, Jeffrey Wright, you're here. I love you. I really enjoy all of the character design of so many of these people. Freddie Rodriguez as Reggie, the one-armed muscle builder who's just building up one of his arms. I just love that.
It's so bizarre.
It's so weird that it's great. That's for me, the moments like that shine through where it's like, how did you come up with that totally bizarre idea that just is kind of such a peculiar character? And he ends up being very important in another scene, in the climactic scene, which I really like, as he ends up being sort of this guardian role. And I do really love that shot of him standing there staring down the scrunt, and he just sort of drops his plate full of, you know, barbecue food or whatever. But it's just going for those sorts of like little, you know, you can afford in a movie with so many secondary characters who don't really need to be delved into that much. You have a line or two elucidating them here or there. And that in some ways is much easier to build those types of characters than it is to build a central character who is fully fleshed out and three-dimensional, right? Like you can get away with doing these sort of brief sketches of things. And I think Shyamalan does a good job with that. I feel like so many of the apartment complexes who are denizens who are only briefly seen are in some ways more memorable than the more fully fleshed out characters. I love the hipster stoners trying to come up with their catchphrases and being generally kind of useless. And more to the point, I like again that this all sort of comes together in all these disparate characters who seem, you know, to in some ways be against type of the roles that they end up playing. I enjoy that element of taking characters who we recognize might sort of identify with from a real world point of view. Like, oh yes, there's the huge family of Latina women, the nosy wife who, you know, is always telling all her husband's secrets, and turning those into mythological characters, taking the mundane and making that mythological is sort of, again, I realize there are some muddled parts where it comes to the plot, but I love that idea. And I think that the execution, while flawed, I think that the idea of it is really the part that I sort of resonate with.
You're right. And I think that actually is another sort of parallel, if you like, to the Star Wars prequels, because that's always been my feeling about the prequels, is that the ideas are good, but the execution lets it down. And unfortunately, you know, in movies, execution is, well, in any storytelling, really, execution is, you know, half the battle. But yeah, I agree. I like the idea of making the mundane fantastical. I like the idea of the residents all sort of slowly, gradually realizing their roles to play in this fantasy story. I was concerned at the start that we were just going to get a bunch of people with quirks. Oh, this is somebody with a quirk, and here's somebody with another quirk, and here's somebody with a different quirk, rather than personalities. And a couple of them do fall into that, but through the course of the movie, most of them do develop actual personalities, which is much more interesting. So yeah, I was generally in favor of, as you say, of the idea of that, but you know, again, the execution. And part of the problem, I think, was that line you said from the critic where everybody's just standing around,
yeah,
saying their feelings out loud. Well, that doesn't happen here. That people don't talk about their feelings all that much, but what they do talk about is the story.
Yeah,
like people tell you what's happening and what's going to happen so often in this movie. Like every 5 minutes, it seems they're stopping to tell you about either the fairy tale sort of mythology backstory or about the prediction and prophecy of what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is the difficulty in this situation, is that because, I mean, in a certain sense, it makes sense because they are trying to suss out like what is supposed to be going on. I do enjoy that the only source he has for this story is his I think Chinese neighbor's mother, who only speaks Chinese, and so he has to relay everything through her. But it is laid out a lot of the time, you know, as sort of like, this is going to happen, you need to do this, you need to do this, which is again not you know, not uncharacteristic of fairy tales, where you're, you know, often told you need to journey to this castle and do this and defeat the dragon, etc. Like, there is certainly an element of that, but you're right that it's overly harped upon and told rather than shown, insofar as that's possible. And so that is also, you know, sort of makes it tricky when it comes to sort of elucidating what is really the point you are trying to get across here.
Well, and why it's important to the story. Again, there's very little significance attached to it. It's just kind of, you have to do this. Well, why? Well, because that's the rules.
Right. And I think there needs to be something stronger.
You can get away with a certain amount of that in this kind of story, but it just feels like there's a bit too much.
Yeah. And I think it suffers in that way because I think, so there's that, I kind of enjoyed there's a little, at the beginning, during the credit sequence, there's that little animated voiced over section, which is supposed to sort of elucidate the past of, like, there were these creatures, they were in contact with man left and decided to, you know, it became increasingly warlike and fighting, and they tried to, you know, the Narfs tried to essentially reach them again, but had trouble with that. But upon reviewing it this time, I found the problem with that story is that it needed to be a little more straightforward, because even if fairy tales are complex,
it's rather convoluted. Yeah.
Yeah. Even if fairy tales are complex, again, in sort of the way that they eventually work out, there needs to be a clarity of purpose in the way that's laid down, because these things are supposed to be simple ideas, right? They're supposed to be very straightforward, very like streamlined. Like, this is, you know, this is what happens when things are bad, because they're made to explain things. They're made to, you know, have a purpose of being like a cautionary tale or something, right? They have morals, etc. And in this case, what exactly is at stake is unclear, because we don't know. It's not very well explained why she needs to, where she is going and what she's going to do when she gets there that makes a difference to these people here and now. And I kind of, you know, again, I think there is some self-indulgence going on here, because, as you said, based on his own story that he's telling for his kids. And, you know, I've told story for my cousin's kids and stuff like that when I'm trying to, you know, like, you know, tell them a story before going to sleep. And those definitely get muddled because you're making it up as you go along, right? And there is no editing process. But when you turn it into a movie, you have the benefit of an editing process, at which point you need to trim down and be like, okay, I was trying to get at this point, or here are the elements I liked from that story, but here's how I make it fit in the framework of an actual, you know, plot.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, that issue of there needed to be a clearer moral or clearer, you know, a concept of what the stakes are and why this is so important. And they try to sort of backfill that about halfway through with it turning out that she's like a queen to her people. But that just honestly kind of doesn't really catch you in the same way. So
all that does is give the villain, the Skrunt, an excuse to attack her. That's like the only purpose of that entire thing about her being a queen is to put her in more danger. yeah, it's the whole thing, as you say, the opening narration, it's nice. David Ogden Stiers narrating, good. Lovely sort of, you know, primitive style artwork for the animation. It looks kind of mythic and fairy tale like. Yeah, that's really good. But yeah, as you say, very convoluted and does not, like, her whole sort of mission, if you like, in this has no parallel in what we're told
right
at the start either. It's got nothing to do with that opening narration about why they originally came here and why they went back to the sea and stuff. It's, they seem, you know, they're completely unrelated.
No, I agree. I mean, and there are elements that cross over between the two of them. But when I, you know, thought back and tried to apply what was going on to what was described there, you're right. It totally falls apart, which is unfortunate because, again, that could have been very lovely piece of synergy there. And exactly. More the point, it needs to be reflected in, you know, when we talked about the hero's journey stuff, it needs to be reflected in the plot of what's happening with Cleveland and our denizens in the apartment building in some way. Like, even if it's not directly, like, she goes out and she does something that directly deal, you know, helps them, I feel like it needs to be a mirror of what is happening in this world here. And too much of that emphasis is, again, placed on Shyamalan's character of being free to go and do these things that will eventually change the world, which I think would have been more, it would have been more interesting in some ways, you know, though less self-indulgent of being a writer. And there's nothing writers like to write about more than writers who are
the
heroes.
Writers, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, having Cleveland Heap be, you know, maybe a doctor who goes out and actually, you know, saves people again would seem to me a more powerful message potentially.
Right. And I mean, they do tie that in one way when it's revealed that he's not the guardian, he's the healer.
Yep.
Which he assumed was somebody else, and that, you know, and that's obviously tying into him having formerly been a doctor. So that works. That's one of the few sort of things where it actually ties together and you're like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yep. Yep.
I would like to also just quickly mention that Bill Irwin has a very, very minor role in this movie, playing sort of, you know, for one of the few roles where he doesn't do anything physical and he's not doing physical comedy or really comedy of any kind. But he's actually a bit like when Robin Williams decided to start playing serial killers. seeing him as this really serious, intense, tragic character is actually, he's really, really good.
Oh, yeah, he has very few scenes, but the scenes he does have are so heavy on the impact.
Really affecting and powerful, yeah.
And especially because you don't, again, I really like the portrayal and the presentation of his character, who, again, we initially see through a doorway, sort of sitting in his armchair watching. And he's kind of... You know, he's the, I guess he's sort of the cynic, right? Like, they're jaded, right? Like, he's constantly watching, like, war, you know, like, the news, basically, and all these terrible things happening everywhere.
Right.
And you kind of get the impression that he suffered something similar, maybe, to Giamatti's character, some sort of loss, because he warns him at one point not to end up like him. And then he, at the end, he has a very heartfelt moment of, like, telling, you know, Paul Giamatti, like, you need to do this, right? Like, you know, I wanted to believe that there was something else, which I don't know, in my head, as soon as we get in the headcanon areas, like, I always assume maybe he had lost a child or something, you know, to the war or something like that, because there is sort of, and he does, but, like, with those few lines, he does convey, like, an amazing amount of, like, pain and hope and all that stuff. So a really great, you know, a really great moment for just a character who's only seen rather briefly.
He's in like three scenes. Yeah. I assumed that he was a veteran himself, actually. And that was, was undergoing some kind of trauma. But again, you know, we don't know. But there, like, he's in three scenes and we're speculating of thoughts that we had about this character. That's what a good performance can do.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he is.
Yeah. And I mean, I also wanted to call out the other couple, like, performances in here that I really enjoyed. Although not a great performance, I really love seeing Jared Harris appear here as one of the stoners, who would then go on to be on Mad Men and Moriarty in the Guy Ritchie Sherlock Holmes movies.
Yeah.
And I was like, so weird to see you as like the hippie, you know, guy coming up with the catchphrases and whatever. And I really, the young boy, Noah Gray Cabey, who also shows up around the same time he was on Heroes as a kid with powers. I think Shyamalan is actually really good at coaxing great performances out of child actors. Like, that's one of his, if you look over the course of his career.
Well, look at Haley Joel Osment.
Yeah, Haley Joel Osment. Yeah. The kids in, even in Unbreakable, I think the Bruce Willis's sons are done well. I think, I actually haven't seen Signs, but I know there are some kids in there too. It's a lot of this movie to me harkens back, and you know, maybe Shyamalan, I think he's probably pretty close in age to me. Yeah, he's a little older than me.
He's closer to me than you.
But he clearly grew up with these 1980s movies, and this movie definitely has like that 1980 vibe. I mean, I was thinking about the apartment building, and it reminded me of like the apartment building from like The Karate Kid. And I was like, wow, yeah, okay, I can kind of see that. So I feel like he's trying to do a vibe of like the whole, almost the whole Spielbergian thing. Like, I think J.J. Abrams tried to do something similar and probably maybe a little more successfully in that with a Super 8, with the conveyance of that like period piece of like the kids running around, you know, mystery, sort of unknown forces, you know, and there is sort of that. It feels almost in some ways like an 80s movie to me, although then if you cut out more of the self-indulgent crap, I think it's a better job of it.
I mean, overall, I would say I am watching this movie made me quite angry at times. but I am glad, for all the reasons that I've previously outlined, but I am glad that I watched it, actually, because, as you know, a writer myself, every so often it pays to be reminded that, because we all, you know, every writer, I think, a fiction writer, thinks, oh, I want to write a sort of enigmatic, stylized storybook mm-hmm. type thing, you know, about like ancient creatures and arbitrary rules of the world of fairy, and leave the reader to work things out. Be enigmatic. And that's fine. But this movie serves as a reminder that to do that successfully, it still needs to make some kind of internal sense. And I couldn't help, I kept thinking of Donnie Darko, which, you know, was not far off the same, released a few years earlier than this, but, you know, not far off, around the same sort of era. And the difference with that, it was in Donnie Darko, you're confused as hell because nobody will tell you what's happening. But you always had a sense that Richard Kelly, if nobody else, at least Richard Kelly knew what was going on and that if he wanted to, he could explain it to you and that it would make sense. Whereas here, people are falling over themselves to tell you what's happening, but it still doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, right.
And so it's kind of, I think, instructive in that sense. Because, yeah, I think it's a good, somebody who is familiar with how fiction works can look at this and go, this has the potential to be so good, and yet, you know, falls down because of not many, but a few vital elements that are, you know, either executed badly or just missing. And so I think, actually, I would say, if there are any writers out there, all budding writers out there, you probably should watch this movie, because I found it really instructive in that sense.
Yeah, no, I agree. I start to wonder if maybe, and maybe I'm sort of buying into this too much, but I start to wonder if M. Night Shyamalan is kind of on the hero's journey himself, where he like started out really strong and then he, you know, like totally like bought into his own hype and he just became too overly concerned with what people thought about him. And now he's maybe, I've heard better things about his more recent movies. Not that they're, I'm never a big horror fan, so I didn't go in for that sort of thing, but I like his, again, I think he's a very talented director. And I think, you know, again, maybe in another decade, when people have sort of left a lot of that stuff behind, because I have never seen a reaction to M. Night Shyamalan to anybody else. I mean, I remember being in the theater with some movie, I think it was a movie called Devil, which he didn't even direct. He produced it, I think, and maybe wrote it. And it had that, like, from the mind of M. Night Shyamalan. And people booed. I don't ever remember ever seeing that. Even with, like, I mean,
hey, nobody's going to boo Ron Howard, you know?
Yeah, exactly. No matter how bad it gets, people just be like, eh, yeah, whatever. But, like, I've never seen anybody evince that much anger from people. And that's fascinating to me, because you've got to do something pretty bad, I feel like, to get actively booed by people. Like, and so that says to me, like, there's a certain amount of influence here for good and for bad. Like the fact that he can get people to go to such extreme reactions.
Right. At least you're engendering such a strong reaction.
Exactly.
In people, yeah.
Better to be hated than it is to be like meh, right? Like to
Absolutely,
have people indifferent
yeah.
to you. So I wonder if we'll see, maybe someday he'll be able to sort of, you know, come back having learned a lot and finally like sort of, you know, do the kind of work that I think we'd like to see from him. Because I think, again, I think we all believe him to be talented. He just kind of needed to grow up a little bit.
Yeah, there is a very common path in for some creators and performers where they, especially ones who have very rapid rise to success,
yes.
where, yes, they do kind of burn out and falter and stumble. And the ones who go away for a bit, the ones who literally just go away and do, like in an actor's case, just go and do theatre, because
mm-hmm. right.
nobody cares about theatre, you know. Or in a musician's case, you know, go and like live in a commune in Scandinavia for 5 years. That, do you know what I mean? Like,
yep.
Or what was his, Leonard Cohen went and lived as a monk, literally became a monk for like 5 or 6 years, didn't he?
Yes.
You know, people who do that, and then they come back refreshed and, you know, probably a bit wiser, and with a little more perspective, and then have a sort of successful renaissance of
yep.
their careers. We see this over and over and over again with creative people.
Yep.
And yeah, I think maybe it's time for Shyamalan to do that. Maybe it's time for him to sort of just go away for a bit, concentrate on raising his kids, although I'm not sure how old, they're probably grown up now,
yeah.
You know, and just sort of, and then come back. Because you're right, he is clearly a very, very talented man. He is an opinionated filmmaker, and that's good.
I applaud that.
And I also applaud his tenacity. You know, much as I don't like many of his later films, I applaud the fact that he is willing to make them and sort of stick two fingers up and say, I'm just going to make the films I want to make, and I don't care. Except that, of course, he does care, and he kind of shows it in this movie that actually
yeah,
he
yeah.
cares quite a bit. And I think that's where he needs to maybe get more perspective, and you know, maybe in another 5-10 years time he will have that. And I certainly, you know, I look forward to a renaissance of his career. I look forward to seeing that if it does happen, because yeah, I think he is a very, very good filmmaker who clearly is talented and has an eye for unusual idiosyncratic movie making, and we do need more of that. I just wish they were better.
yep Yeah, I agree. All of those things I agree with. I think he is incredibly talented, has a great technical sense, and just, yeah, maybe he's just convinced a little too much of his own importance and needs to take that break, or at least maybe go. I know I had heard mixed things about the television series he had been doing, but maybe even that is like, go off and do television, because nobody really thinks about who you are on television.
Very few, it's ironic, very few people pay any attention to the writers of television. And yet, of course, in television, writers have so much more power than they do in movies. But I think given that he doesn't just write, but he also directs and produces most of his movies as well, it's, you know, it does have that auteur kind of feel to it, his work, whereas it wouldn't in television. It's incredibly unlikely that he would also direct and, you know, as well as write and, you know, be in overall production control as well of anything.
Yeah,
really.
that's very dangerous. As you brought up George Lucas, obviously a sore spot for me, but I totally agree with you there. There's just at a certain point when there's nobody else to challenge you and to make you think harder about the choices you're making, it's really hard to produce a great piece of work there. Because even writers, as we know, who, you know, end up having, like, it's your name on the front of the book, right? And it's a very solo endeavor. But we have editors and beta, you know, readers and all of that. Like, all those things that make us challenge the ideas that we put down and say, well, okay, am I going to do it this way? Or, do you know, should I make this choice for this reason? So you need someone to sort of run up against in order to make your ideas better.
Absolutely. So yeah, a wall to run into and make you sort of, you know, have another go.
Yeah, we run into a lot of walls as writers.
I almost feel like I should apologize for sort of not liking this movie at all. Because the last time you were on, obviously,
Yes, it was a little more of a love fest.
It was an absolute love fest because we both absolutely adore Hudson Hawk. And then this time around, you chose a movie that turns out I really, really did not like.
That's fine. I mean, I think this is the whole point of this show. I know I'm in the minority for liking this movie. And, you know, again,
right.
I totally admit that it is flawed. You know, I just don't think it's necessarily flawed beyond some redemptive qualities. Like you said, I think there are things to learn from this. I think there are things about it to like. It is not just like an absolute terrible bomb of a movie. There are way worse movies than this.
Oh, God,
and I think that's the problem is like, it's sort of the pivot point for where everybody was like, oh, M. Night Shyamalan, he is like totally lost it. And I can understand why after all of the other movies that he has done, people would think that. But I think so much of it just had to do with the sort of public, you know, preconceptions and just the weird sort of a hate that he engenders, right? Like, it is weird.
Weird, I agree, yeah.
And because there are so many other filmmakers who I think do so much worse work than him, just overall, right? Like, I mean, Michael Bay, I mean, he's made some good movies, but like, oh God, I cannot stand
so
much of what he
does. Nobody boos Michael Bay, they just roll their eyes.
Yeah, exactly. You laugh, you roll your eyes, whatever. But like, people feel so betrayed, and I don't know, it's hard to pin down why, because I understand like the idea of having movies with a twist where you might feel betrayed, but I feel like his movies, his twists aren't necessarily that kind of twist where it's like, ah, I made you look dumb for watching this movie, which is what I think people would get angry about, right? Like, even Unbreakable, which I know you've mentioned your problems with, like, I feel like the twist there, I didn't see it coming, at least, and I felt when I watched it that I was like, oh wow, that was okay, I can kind of see what you're doing there, but it didn't make me angry. Like, and there's so many movies that you've paid for probably in your life and come out of and be like, well, that was a waste of $10 or whatever, that I just don't understand why he in particular engenders that much animosity.
Yeah, no, I don't get it either. I mean, Unbreakable, like I say, I really didn't like Unbreakable at all. And it's mainly because of the climax, the last sort of 10 minutes of the movie. Mm-hmm. But I didn't come out hating Shyamalan. And I wouldn't boo him if I saw his name on the screen.
Exactly. You know,
that's kind of extreme, guys.
It is. And yet it was a phenomenon, because I heard about it happening in other places. And yet to experience it for yourself, it was weird.
All right, Dan Morin, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
I am on Twitter, at dmorin. You can find a lot of my writing at sixcolors.com and Macworld, and I'm the host of Inconceivable, the game show on The Incomparable, which Anthony has been on, and the tech podcast, The Rebound.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned, and please remember to check out my comics, books, and music. Go to anthonyjohnston.com for information and links to all of my work. You can support the show by rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes, and if you really like it, please leave a review. It's the best way to spread the word to new listeners. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find information, links, and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
I hope that someday our work can lead people to boo us.
Do you know what I look forward to? The remake.
Yeah, well, so I was thinking about that. Like, so the problem with it is, like, all the things that make this movie good are the technical things. And so, like, in some ways, a lot of times you see movies where you want to see the remake because you're like, oh, well, the story was good, but it just wasn't executed, wasn't, like, shot very well.
It looks cheap, or
right,
yeah,
the actors
have
are
the
bad,
budget, yeah,
or
yeah,
whatever. In this case, it's like, oh,
it's
that's
the
good.
Other way around. Yeah,
someone needs to rewrite it and do it again. So maybe they'll put it out. How about like a play? I'd love to see this on the stage. That would be hilarious.
Yeah.
I think that could actually be. You know, sorry, if David Lohr is listening to this, he's probably already. Yes. I already started writing a theatrical
work,
version
yeah.
of this
no,
10 years
you're,
ago.
You're right, because it's you've got the limited locations, you know, and the sort of the static locations, as you said, and you know. yeah, it's, I think actually it could work as a stage play with some heavy rewriting.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. But yeah, the elements are all there. There's not, you can easily do the monsters and things like that with it.
Yeah.
And yeah. So yeah, that would be a really interesting direction for him to take. I'm not sure he would ever think about that, but maybe somebody else will.
You mentioned writers writing about writers. And I just specifically wanted to save this for the after show because I actually have very deliberately never done that.
That's smart.
It's one thing that I'm not going to say I will never do it, but I am really, really wary of doing it because it is such a cliche.
Yep.
It is such a, oh, look, the main character just happens to be a writer who's about the same age and background as the author.
Yep.
What a surprise, you know. And then it just becomes wish fulfillment and Mary Sue stuff. That was a lot of people, I haven't read them, but a lot of people I know who read the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo books
really
didn't like them because...
The similarities of the protagonist and the writer, sure.
With the author, exactly, yeah. Because they were just like, well, this is clearly just author insertion. Like, what is going on here?
And I totally understand where you're coming from. I wish I could claim to do the same, but in my senior year of college, I took a screenwriting class, and I wrote, and I thought it was funny when you mentioned the part, like, every writer wants to at some point write a story where, like, there's monsters and the rules are undefined and, you know, have people figure it out. And so I wrote that story. I wrote that screenplay in college.
I think we've all written that story. That's
and
what
the
I'm
main
saying.
Character was a writer. So there you go. Hey! I got two strikes in one.
I don't know why that is exactly. You know, I'm sure there's probably some evolutionary, you know, pathologist or something could probably tell me. But anthropologist, what am I saying? But not pathologist. Good Lord. we're watching too much CSI.
I'm going back to writing about space marines. They're nothing like me.
Yeah. Yeah. Back away from the word processor.